Live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studios, this is Bloomberg Daybreak for Tuesday, May 14th, 2019. Coming up this hour.
U.S. futures rebound as traders assess the turmoil over trade.
In the last few innings of any trade negotiation, it's a time where things are most fragile.
President Trump keeping an optimistic tone.
I have a feeling it's going to be very successful.
Now Wall Street awaits a meeting between Presidents Trump and Xi next month.
There's a new investigation to examine the origins of the Russia probe. Plus, former Deputy AG Rod Rosenstein takes verbal swipes at ex-FBI Director Comey. I'm Michael Barr. More ahead.
I'm John Stashower on sports. Yankees and Orioles were rained out. They'll play a doubleheader tomorrow. St. Louis beat San Jose in the Stanley Cup playoffs.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak. On Bloomberg 1130 New York. Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C. Bloomberg 1061 Boston. Bloomberg 960 San Francisco. Sirius XM 119. And around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good morning, I'm Karen Moscow.
I'm Nathan Hager. Bloomberg Daybreak brought to you by BNY Mellon's Pershing. Experience Insight, the essential event for the financial advice community. Visit BNYMellonInsight.com to learn more and register today.
U.S. futures and European stocks are rebounding after the worst sell-off since January. 501 on Wall Street, and we check the markets every 15 minutes throughout the trading day on Bloomberg. S&P futures are up about 14 points. Dow futures up 92. NASDAQ futures up 52. The DAX in Germany is up 0.25%. CAC in Paris up 0.6%. And the FTSE 100 up almost 0.7%. Nikkei 225 in Japan was down 0.6%, while the Hang Seng in Hong Kong fell 1.5%. 10-year Treasury down 3/32, yield 2.41%. Yield on the two-year is at 2.19%. NYMEX crude oil is down 0.25%, down 17 cents to $60.90 a barrel. COMEX gold down 0.3% or $3.80 to $12.98 an ounce. The euro at 1.1239 against the dollar. The yen at 109.67. Nathan.
Karen, a meeting between Presidents Trump and Xi next month is shaping up to be pivotal when it comes to U.S.-China trade negotiations.
Well, let you know in about 3 or 4 weeks whether or not it was successful. You never really know, right? But I have a feeling it's going to be very successful.
President says he will meet China's leader at next month's G20 summit after his administration released another list of Chinese goods it could hit with tariffs.
We have the right to do another $325 billion at 25% in additional tariffs. That is a tremendous amount of money that would come into our country. I have not made that decision yet.
If enacted, that next round of tariffs would hit U.S. consumers directly. For the first time, Bloomberg's Jody Schneider has details.
There's about $300 billion in Chinese goods on that list, including a number of consumer items such as children's clothing, toys, cell phones, laptops. If he goes ahead with this list, that would mean that almost all imports from China would be covered by punitive duties.
An escalation in the trade war has hit farm commodities hardest, with soybean futures falling to the lowest level in a decade yesterday. The futures in Chicago this morning are rebounding after word Presidents Trump and Xi will meet next month.
U.S. stock index futures are also rebounding this morning after yesterday's 2.4% decline for the S&P 500. Libby Cantrill is head of public policy at PIMCO.
In the last few innings of any trade negotiation, it's a time where things are most fragile. And so, yes, we were hopeful that they were going to meet a resolution, but there was also some downside risk, and I think the markets really were ignoring that sort of reality.
The new round of tariffs outlined by the White House wouldn't take effect until late June at the earliest, giving negotiators another month to talk before tensions escalate again. Former U.S. Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez.
We're so close. But on the other hand, unless we change expectations and we decide that we can't get everything, but we're going to get a substantial amount, I don't see then how a deal can be had.
All eyes are now on the G20 summit in Japan, set for June 28th.
While U.S. futures and European equities are rebounding, it was another down day for stocks in Asia. Bloomberg's Juliet Sally joins us from Singapore with details. Good morning, Juliet.
Good morning, Nathan and Karen. Well, the losses in Asia weren't as pronounced as those seen on Wall Street Monday, and the Nikkei 225 actually paired an earlier loss of more than 2% to finish down just 0.6% in Tokyo. The offshore yuan rose for the first time in 7 sessions. The yen lost ground while the Aussie and Kiwi were bid. Hong Kong's cash market was hit hardest during Tuesday's trade as it played catch-up to Monday's price action. The city-state's markets had been closed for a public holiday. In Singapore, I'm Juliet Sali, Bloomberg Daybreak.
Juliet, thank you. The market volatility has traders more convinced than ever that the Federal Reserve will cut rates this year. Bloomberg's John Tucker joins us live with the very latest. Good morning, John.
Yeah, Karen, concerns are building that the trade war will hamper economic growth. Fed funds futures are now pricing in a full quarter point reduction by the end of the year and a second by mid-2020. That's a reversal from just 2 weeks ago when Fed Chair Jerome Powell made clear that policymakers view the economic outlook as solid. While the broader market is starting to price one Fed rate cut this year, the options market is seeing something more aggressive. Bets are cropping up in the euro-dollar options market for two or three quarter point reductions. John Tucker, Bloomberg Daybreak.
All right, John, thank you. And a programming note, stay tuned for a conversation with John Williams. The New York Fed president sits down for an exclusive interview with Bloomberg Radio and Television at 5:30 a.m. Wall Street time, just under 30 minutes from now.
All right, turning to corporate news now. Shares of Bayer are down more than 2.5% after a jury ordered the company to pay $2 billion in damages over claims its Roundup weed killer causes cancer. Bloomberg's Charlie Pellet has the story.
It is the largest jury award in the U.S. so far this year and the eighth largest ever in a product defect claim. Bayer, which said it will appeal the verdict, has now lost three trials in a row over claims Roundup causes cancer. Charlie Pellet, Bloomberg Daybreak.
All right, Charlie, thank you. Shares of Uber are up more than 1.9% in early trading after a rough debut on Wall Street. The stock slumped 7% on Friday and another 11% yesterday. It'll look to reverse that trend today.
Shares of Volkswagen are up about 0.75% as it revives plans for an IPO of its heavy trucks division. VW says it hopes to list the business by August.
Nissan Motor out with earnings that missed estimates. The automaker also forecasting profit that falls short of expectations and cut its dividend.
Tesla is also in focus after one of its vehicles reportedly caught fire while in a Hong Kong parking lot. According to the Hong Kong Economic Times, a Tesla Model S started to smoke before catching fire while parked in the lot.
And Bitcoin is taking another leg higher this morning. The digital currency has strengthened past $8,000 for the first time in 10 months. Straight ahead, the latest world and national news. This is Bloomberg.
And at 5:07 on Wall Street, we bring in Michael Barr with more of what's going on around the world. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Nathan. A second investigation about the origins of the Russia investigation has been ordered. According to multiple reports, Attorney General William Barr has appointed the U.S. Attorney in Connecticut, John Durham, to conduct the inquiry into the Russia investigation's origins and whether intelligence gathering involving the Trump campaign was lawful and appropriate. A similar investigation by the Justice Department's Inspector General is underway. Former Deputy Attorney General Ron Rosenstein is taking verbal shots at both James Comey and Republican detractors. Bloomberg's Ed Baxter has the story.
Rosenstein has been under attack by both sides of the political spectrum and has launched a public attack on former FBI Director Comey defending Robert Mueller's investigation. He also has drawn a line with Republicans as well who say they want to know if there were political motivations for the probe itself. He says that was not the case. In a Baltimore speech, Rosenstein says Comey is now a partisan pundit selling books and earning speaking fees while speculating about the strength of his character and the fate of, in his words, my immortal soul.
Speculating about souls is not a job for police and prosecutors. Generally, we base our opinions on eyewitness testimony.
In San Francisco, I'm Ed Baxter, Bloomberg Daybreak.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made little progress persuading European Union counterparts to take a harder line toward Iran during a quick visit to Brussels, with the EU standing behind the nuclear accord abandoned by Washington. Pompeo presented what the U.S. says is fresh intelligence on the threat posed by Iran. Meanwhile, President Trump has sent a warning to Iran. The president was asked about what he plans to do after learning about a sabotage attack on two Saudi oil tankers off the coast of the United Arab Emirates.
It's going to be a bad problem for Iran if something happens, I can tell you that. They're not going to be happy. They are not going to be happy people. Okay? You can figure it out yourself.
The president made his comments at the White House with the visiting Hungarian prime minister at his side. President Trump said far-right Prime Minister Viktor Orban is doing a good job with a hard-line approach to immigration. Global News, 24 hours a day, on air and at TikTok on Twitter, powered by more than 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries. I'm Michael Barr. This is Bloomberg, Nathan.
Thanks, Michael. It's 5:09 on Wall Street. Now it's time for the Bloomberg NBC Sports Update. Here's John Stashower.
Nathan, this is a big night for the Knicks. They just lost 65 games. Will it pay off by winning the draft lottery? It's a year where there's a big prize. Duke's Zion Williamson, considered a can't-miss star. Unfortunately, the NBA changed the rules in an effort to curb tanking. The team with the worst record used to have a 25% chance of winning the lottery. It's now 14%, the same as two other teams, Cleveland and Phoenix. Patrick Ewing, the former Knicks star and current Georgetown coach, will be on the stage in Chicago. He became a Knick when they won the first ever lottery in 1985. After the lottery comes game one of the Western Conference Finals, Portland at Golden State. Nearby in San Jose, St. Louis Blues won last night 4-2. Game two of that West Final series now tied at one. No game in the Bronx. They waited 2 hours. Aaron Boone was watching the Doppler.
You're getting ready to play. Everyone's getting hot. And, you get your pitcher warmed up and stuff. And then, realize that, obviously, I think everyone saw by the images and whatnot that, it just wasn't playable. Then all of a sudden, the emerging thought that maybe more rain was on the way. Definitely, I think, the right call to put this one off.
So the Yankees and Orioles will play tonight and then play a doubleheader tomorrow before Thursday's day off. Mets haven't played since Saturday. They're in Washington tonight. The PGA Championship tees off Thursday. Bethpage Black on Long Island. Tiger Woods going for back-to-back majors. Brooks Koepka, the defending champion. Justin Thomas won the PGA 2 years ago. He's pulled out with a wrist injury. With the Bloomberg NBC Sports Update, I'm John Stashower. Nathan?
All right, John, thank you. And the PGA Championship is just 2 days away. It's been hard, though, to distinguish between tour pros and club pros, major champions and major rookies during the first official day of practice on Long Island's Bethpage Black. That's because everybody was bundled in dark rain gear as temperatures remain in the upper 40s, though it should get better by the weekend with temperatures pushing 70 degrees. By the way, you can catch all the action, rain or shine, right here on Bloomberg Radio beginning Thursday afternoon. Futures pointing higher. S&P futures up 14 points. Dow futures up 103. NASDAQ futures up 56 points. You're listening to Bloomberg Daybreak. Good morning. Coming up to 5:12 on Wall Street, Bloomberg Daybreak is brought to you by National Realty. NRIA, developers of high-return income-producing properties. For investor partners, see them at NRIA.net.
Markets, headlines, and breaking news 24 hours a day at Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Business app, and at TikTok on Twitter. This is a Bloomberg Business Flash.
And I'm Karen Moscow. U.S. stock index futures are rising alongside European equities while shares in Asia dropped as investors assess the prospects for global trade in the wake of a brutal start to the week for markets. Contracts on the S&P 500, Dow Jones Industrial Average, and NASDAQ 100 indexes all climbing after President Trump predicted talks with China will be very successful, even as the U.S. prepares to hit the country with fresh tariffs. We check the markets every 15 minutes throughout the trading day on Bloomberg. S&P futures are up 15 points, Dow futures up 108, NASDAQ futures up 55, the DAX in Germany is up 0.25%, 10-year Treasury down 3/32, the yield 2.41%, the yield on the 2-year 2.19%. NYMEX crude oil down 0.3% or 17 cents to $60.87 a barrel. COMEX gold down 0.25% or $3.30 to $12.98.50 an ounce. The euro at 1.1240 against the dollar, the yen 109.68. And U.S. small business optimism rose more than expected in April. It rose from 101.8 to 103.5. And today we are looking for reports on the import price index at 8:30 Wall Street time. And Ralph Lauren, among companies scheduled to report earnings today. That's a Bloomberg Business Flash. Now here's Michael Barr with more on what's going on around the world. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, Karen. There is a new investigation stemming from Russia's interference in the 2016 election. Attorney General William Barr has now assigned the top federal prosecutor in Connecticut, John Durham, to examine the origins of the Russia probe and determine if intelligence collection surrounding the Trump campaign was lawful. Former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein launched a public attack on former FBI Director James Comey. During a speech last night to the Greater Baltimore Committee, Rosenstein referred to Comey as a partisan pundit. In baseball, the Yankees-Orioles game was postponed. The A's lost. NHL playoffs, the Blues beat the Sharks 4-2. That evens the series at a game apiece. Tonight is the NBA draft lottery. The three teams in front to get the number one pick are the Knicks, Cavaliers, and Suns, each with a 14% chance. But the consensus top prospect is Zion Williamson. Global News, 24 hours a day on air and at TikTok on Twitter, powered by more than 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries. I'm Michael Barr. This is Bloomberg, Nathan.
Thank you, Michael. We're coming up to 5:20 on Wall Street, live from the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studios. This is Bloomberg Daybreak, and we're joined this morning by Lindsay Piegza, chief economist at Stifel Nicolaus, as we continue to assess the potential impact of this trade war between the U.S. and China. These tariffs that the U.S. is imposing potentially next month, followed by retaliatory tariffs from China, are these the sort that could take a bite into the U.S. and global economy, Lindsay?
Good morning. Well, it's interesting because the earlier tariffs that we saw in 2017-2018, we estimate shaved off about 0.2 percentage point from top-line GDP here in the U.S. But as we look out to these additional tariffs and, of course, the proposal for even more levies on the remaining balance, we could start to see maybe 0.3 or more shaved off from top-line GDP in 2019. What we have to remember is that 10%, many businesses struggle to pass on those cost increases to the consumer without the risk of losing market share. At 25%, it's going to be much more difficult for corporations to absorb that cost increase. And in fact, we are likely to see much more of a pass-through directly to the consumer, with businesses really struggling to find efficiencies or other areas of increasing productivity to, again, eat that cost increase that will hit their bottom line.
Do you see these increased tariffs as a negotiation tactic, as the White House has termed it in the past, or is there a risk that if they get imposed, that they could become permanent?
Well, I do think, to the president's point, we've seen U.S. and Chinese officials now actively engaged in negotiations for more than 10 months. Well surpassing the original March 1 deadline. So the Trump administration has been clear that they're committed to reaching a compromise, but they also felt it was necessary to increase pressure on Beijing, or they run the risk of drawing out these talks indefinitely. So certainly there is some political move here, some pressure added to Beijing in order to try and reach that end goal of a deal. And if, in fact, we do see negotiations pan out, a meaningful deal, it is likely that the Trump administration at least lessens, maybe not entirely rolls back, but lessens the tariffs that we've seen put in place over the more than year time at this point.
When you're talking about a meaningful deal, you're talking about structural changes to the Chinese economy as opposed to just more purchases of U.S. goods?
Maybe not necessarily structural changes, but at least some sort of commitment towards a structural change. Remember, this is going to be a very significant and expected longer-term negotiating process. So I do think that this initial trade deal is just the step in the right direction towards likely a decade-long negotiation between the U.S. and China. It's going to take some time to get to the president's actual goal of leveling, quote, leveling the playing field between the world's two largest economies.
But if the tariffs do take a noticeable bite into GDP, does that, in your view, change the Fed bias toward a rate move later on this year?
Well, I think the Fed is already leaning towards a bias of probably cutting rates by the end of the year, even leaving trade out of it. What we see is that the U.S. economy is very significantly losing momentum. Absolutely, we did see an above-trend top-line GDP number at the start of the year, but we also know that digging below that headline, the vast majority of support came from temporary or one-off factors, including trade, inventories, government spending. But if we strip that out and look at arguably a more organic underlying directional momentum of the economy, looking at real final private domestic sales, well, the economy was just growing at 1.3%, the weakest that we've seen in nearly 6 years, with consumption at a four-quarter low, investment at a two-quarter low. And if we continue to see that retraction in activity at those two key components of the economy, it's very likely that GDP was poised to disappoint sooner rather than later, independent of the latest setback that we've seen in terms of negotiation.
I really appreciate your insight. As always, that's Lindsay Piegza, chief economist at Stifel Nicolaus. And I want to remind you that in just a few minutes, actually, Bloomberg Radio and Television will bring you an exclusive interview with New York Fed President John Williams. That's coming up right around 5:30 Wall Street time. So again, just a few minutes from now. In the meantime, futures on Wall Street pointing to a modestly higher open. S&P futures up 16 points, Dow futures up 117 points. And NASDAQ futures up 59 points. 10-year Treasury yield 2.41%. The 2-year at 2.19%. This is Daybreak. And Bloomberg Daybreak is brought to you by New York Community Bank. Ask about their My Community Interest Checking with free New York Community Bank online and mobile banking. Earn more, get more. Visit mynycb.com for details.
Broadcasting live from the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio in New York. Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C. Bloomberg 991. To Boston. Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco. Bloomberg 960. To the country. Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe. The Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Daybreak.
And it's 5:30 on Wall Street. Good morning. I'm Nathan Hager.
And I'm Karen Moscow. Bloomberg Daybreak brought to you by Eisner Amper, named Best Global Accounting Firm for the third year in a row by Hedgeweek, a leading hedge fund industry publication. Learn more at EisnerAmper.com/FS.
And Karen, we turn now to a conversation with John Williams, the New York Fed president, sitting down for an exclusive with Bloomberg's Kathleen Hayes.
Tom, thank you so very much. Yes, I want to welcome to our audience, our TV audience, I should say, our radio audience around the world, for a very important discussion we're ready to have now with John Williams, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. John, I still have to remind myself that, yes, it's just almost a year, not San Francisco, but New York now. And what a year it's been. And, of course, this year punctuated, hit hard by this escalation of the trade war. You know, first the U.S. broadening the tariffs, boosting the tariffs. China retaliates. When you look at the economy, what do you see? A potential economic shock or just sort of a manageable bump in the road?
Well, I would just start from where we are today, and that is the economy is in a very good place. We've seen solid economic growth, really good job gains, very low unemployment, and inflation a little bit below our target, but I think in a pretty good place. So we're starting, I think, in the big macro picture in a good place, and I think we got monetary policy in a good place. What we need to do at the Fed, and looking ahead of whatever happens, whether it's effects of trade issues or others, is really just keep our focus on achieving our goals, which is maximum employment and price stability. Again, I think we're close to those goals now, and adjusting our policy stance for whatever happens so that we can best achieve those goals.
Well, John, let's look at first quarter growth since you said the economy is in a good place. Yeah. It's not that it's in a bad place.
But when you look at that 3.2% headline print on GDP, it looks great. But when you look inside the report, you see a lot of that was inventory building. And when you look at business investment, which flattened out, when you look at consumption, which slowed pretty sharply in the first quarter so that final sales were up just over 1%, you get a very different picture. And it seems to me a picture where I have to ask you, is this economy vulnerable to a trade war impact at this point?
So first of all, I agree with you. You don't want to overreact to one data point or two data points up or down. And so when I look at that first quarter data, you're right that there are a mixed messages there. What we've seen since that first quarter GDP, in terms of retail sales, consumer spending, and other economic indicators, and importantly, employment growth, is that the economy has rebounded pretty solidly after a bit of a soft patch late last year, early this year. So reading through that data, again, I saw definitely a weakness in the economy earlier this year, but signs of a nice rebound. Again, I think the economy is well positioned to deal with, you know, whatever events can happen in the future.
Where would you look for signs of weakness? Where's your, you know, you've got to be watching this closely. Everybody at the Fed's got to be waiting to see what happens in the politics, but more importantly, where will you look to see worrisome signs in the economy? This trade war is taking a bite.
Well, you know, one area that we're obviously been focused on for quite some time is business confidence, consumer confidence. Again, those are areas that we saw kind of turn down late last year and now have rebounded. So looking at confidence, looking at investment in consumer spending. I mean, if consumers lack confidence or are worried or businesses are nervous about what's happening around either in our country or around the world, they're more likely to pull back on their investment and their plans. Right now, the data, I think, again, is kind of for solid growth, but those are areas we'd be watching for signs of weakness.
Sure, because what happened a couple of months ago is not where we are now, and we're trying to figure out where we go. And in this sense, a very important point a lot of people have made is it may not even be just the, you know, slice and dice the numbers, what's the economic impact, what's the bite that's taken from a trade war. It's the financial market, it's the volatility, it's the uncertainty there, that's the threat to growth. What do you see on that front?
Sure, and let me just start with that first point. In terms of the, you know, what the effects of the tariffs are in terms of growth and inflation, we've already seen some effects, I think, a little boost to inflation, some, you know, subtractions maybe in growth, but those are relatively small so far. Now, as these tariffs get larger, assuming that happens, I think the effects will be bigger, both boosting inflation in the next year and probably having some negative effects on growth. But I do agree that the real issue is about confidence, about uncertainty. When I talk to business leaders around the country, what I hear are, you know, when you're uncertain about what's going to happen with policy or about the economy, you pull back, you hunker down, and you wait to see what happens before you make those investments or hiring decisions. So that's where I'm more focused on, is really about confidence and uncertainty.
We've had a pretty big drop on the stock market. That doesn't only hurt confidence, it tightens financial conditions, right, something the Fed is watching very closely. When we saw the transition on Fed policy from December into January into March, we see that seems to have been one of the things that was clearly on the radar screen, a big pullback in stocks and what it could do to financial conditions and what that could do to the economy. What do you see now? Because it hasn't been too pretty the last few days.
Well, one thing I would separate is between volatility in markets, and markets move up and down. That's what happens. But more focus, as you said, on the broader and more persistent movements in financial conditions. Because you're right, if the financial conditions tighten, that affects households' willingness to spend, businesses willing to invest. And so that is something that is one of the factors that we take into account in thinking about where the economy is likely to go. But the big picture, there's a lot of things that affect the U.S. Growth, and the fundamentals are still pretty solid. Job gains have been good. Real wages have been growing. So I think a lot of the underlying kind of momentum in the economy is still solid. So sure, watch financial conditions. It's an important input into thinking about growth, but not the determining factor.
And John Williams, President of New York Fed, I just want to again thank you for joining me here in Zurich. We've never met in Zurich before, and I also want to thank our radio audience who's joined us in this very important Bloomberg television discussion as well. When you look at the landscape, the Fed has not been including a balance of risk statement so much. But let's say I will, John Williams today, where does this leave us in terms of a balance of risk? Trade war has started. We don't know the impact. We know that there were some vulnerable parts. I mean, again, weaker consumption, not good business investment in the first quarter. Do the risks tilt to the downside now?
So let me step back a little bit to last December and thinking about that balance of risk. Clearly, what we saw late last year, early this year, was slowing global growth and clearly financial conditions tightening. And those are the two areas of risk that I've been particularly focused on. What we've seen on the international front is China's growth is coming better, in part because of the policy actions that the authorities have taken there. Europe is still a mixed picture, and we've seen some weakness in Japan and Korea. So On the global growth side, I think there are some downside risks there. Financial conditions have overall improved quite a bit in the last few months. So I would say overall the balance of risks is roughly where it's been. It's changed a little bit, but still kind of roughly where it's been. I think one thing we don't want to lose track of is the U.S. economy is still steaming ahead through this. So the U.S. data has been better than expected. So, you know, everybody talks about the downside risks, as we should, and focus on that. But of course, we've actually seen some pretty strong numbers in employment, unemployment, that tell me, at least, that the economy's still got good momentum.
Look at the markets. Look at the bond market rally. Yields continue to fall on the benchmark 10-year. Does that send a strong signal? Look at the fact that the yield curve from 3s to 10s briefly inverted again and is still very flat. Look at the fact that the Fed funds futures market is once again pricing in at least one rate hike in 2019. Are the markets reading the Fed's reaction function accurately?
Well, it's always hard to know, you know, whether they're thinking about market participants or thinking about. Clearly, this issue of downside risks is very much in investors' minds, and that's understandable given some of the factors we just talked about. My point of view is always look at the medium term. Where's the economy going in terms of our employment, in terms of inflation, and just try to keep monetary policy in a nice balance, place to keep a nice balance in terms of our goals. So I'm not going to opine whether the markets are right or wrong, because we'll have to wait and see how the data come through and how these risks materialize or don't. And you know, we're in the Fed, we're in that mantra of data dependency. What that means is continuously reassess what are the data telling us about the economy, the outlook for the economy, and really focus on this medium-term view of, you know, how do we best achieve our goals.
Well, the Fed has certainly said that the next move could be in either direction. Right. You'll do what's appropriate. So let me just go a little bit further on this. When does the damage from a trade war, if it continues, people are not looking for anything to end quickly, and once it, even if there starts to be some deal made, the tariffs may stay in place. So when would it become severe enough? That what would the cues tell you, gee, it is time to start looking at a possible rate cut?
So first of all, I do think of the tariffs as in a way is like a negative supply shock. And so it has various effects in the economy. One is it affects inflation. It probably will boost inflation by a few tenths over the next year. It affects demand and growth a bit in the short run, but it also has negative effects on the kind of the value chains and how our economic system works. So I think in thinking about that question, we just have to keep assessing, evaluating what are we learning from the data in terms of those effects, but also the broader set of developments that we're seeing. So I don't think there's any threshold or any specific point. It's really just assessing where we are in inflation in terms of our goal, because we need to get inflation back to 2% and keep it there on a sustained basis, at the same time of making sure that we can sustain this economic expansion as long as possible. So we just have to just assess and evaluate.
Inflation is the other side of the tariff equation, to be sure. Last year, the economy was somewhat shielded by the tariffs because they weren't so much on consumer goods, because China's currency declined, and that helped offset the impact on U.S. importers. How big of a boost in inflation? And again, back of the envelope, we can't be sure. How much could this boost U.S. inflation this year?
So it's hard to know, so I'll start with that and I'll end with that. But I think based on, you know, the research that's happened, the studies have been very detailed looking at this.
War on the table. Have you seen anything? And again, I want to put those two, because those are two big reasons for people to say, hey, maybe the next move is a cut. Have you seen anything that would at least change your dot for this year? I don't even know what your dot is. You can certainly tell us now if you'd like. But I just wonder, is there anything at all that makes you at this point say, I know you're assessing, I know you're in your right place, I know the economy's in a good place, but is there anything at all that's shifting you towards that?
Well, again, I would say that some of the risks that I was worried about before, about maybe the economy slowing faster than we were expecting, that has diminished because the economy seems to have momentum. The events in China have given me a little bit of comfort that they're not going through a hard landing. The lower inflation data obviously is on the other side of that, and some of these other concerns around trade and other factors. I think, you know, there's a lot of risks out there. Fundamentally, I think the policy is right in the right place. I don't see any reason to have a bias upward or downward in the current circumstances. But again, we're going to evaluate, reassess, and see, you know, what's the best decision to get us to our goals.
Well, John Williams, thank you so much for joining us here in Zurich. John Williams, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Pretty soon we'll be able to give you a happy one-year anniversary party. I hope this was the beginning.
Great talking to you.
Great talking to you. Now I'm going to send it back to you.
All right, Bloomberg's Kathleen Hayes. Thank you. Kathleen speaking to New York Fed President John Williams in Zurich. Now let's get you up to date on how stocks are faring ahead of the open this morning, with futures rising alongside European equities, while shares in Asia drop as investors assess the prospects for global trade in the wake of a brutal start to the week for markets. Right now, S&P futures are up 19 points, Dow futures up 144, and NASDAQ futures up 67. The DAX in Germany is up 0.5%, the CAC in Paris up 1%, and the FTSE 100 up 0.8%. 10-year Treasury down 3/32, yield 2.41%, yield on the 2-year 2.19%. NYMEX crude oil little changed, down 2 cents to $61.02 a barrel. COMEX gold is down 0.25% or $3.10 to $12.98.70 an ounce. The euro at 1.1238 against the dollar. The yen at 109.70. And U.S. small business optimism rising more than expected in April from 101.8 to 103.5. And we're also looking today for reports on the import price index at 8:30 Wall Street time. That's a Bloomberg Business Flash. Now here's Michael Barr with more on what's going on around the world. Michael.
Karen, Attorney General William Barr has assigned John Burham, the U.S. attorney in Connecticut, to examine the origins of the Russia probe. It's a move that President Trump has long called for. However, law enforcement officials insist that scrutiny of the Trump campaign was lawful. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made scant progress persuading European Union counterparts to take a harder line toward Iran during a quick visit to Brussels. The EU is standing behind the nuclear accord abandoned by Washington. In baseball, the Yankees-Orioles game was postponed. The A's lost. NHL playoffs, the Blues beat the Sharks. That evens the series at a game apiece. Tonight is the NBA draft lottery. The three teams in front to get the number one pick are the Knicks, Cavaliers, and Suns. Global news 24 hours a day on air and at TikTok on Twitter, powered by more than 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries. I'm Michael Barr. This is Bloomberg, Nathan.
Thanks, Michael. We're live from the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studios, where it's 5:50 on Wall Street. Time for Bloomberg Opinion, our platform offering informed perspectives on a range of global topics and expert data-driven commentary on breaking news. Bloomberg Opinion editor Jennifer Ryan joins us from London as we continue to focus on the U.S.-China trade war. David Fickler writes this morning, Jen, that if we want to understand America's chances of bending China to its will, we need to think about Canada.
That's exactly right. So he says, imagine if Canada decided to bring the U.S. to heel over its abusive trade practices. Well, less than a fifth of U.S. exports head north, so really Canada on its own lacks the scale to bend the U.S. to its will. So there's a lesson here for Washington, because really only about a fifth of Chinese exports go to the U.S., as in the Canadian example. That's equivalent to about 3.5% of its gross domestic product. Sure, that's not nothing, but it's less than half the trade exposure China had in the U.S., before the financial crisis.
So Fickling says this is where regional trade agreements come in.
Yep, there's two that people need to bear in mind. One is the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. That's due to be created in November. It includes a range of regional countries in Southeast Asia, but it includes China. The alternative to this is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which excludes China. It was a deal that was negotiated by the Obama administration and abandoned by Trump and really isn't quite dead. So what's important about either of these? Well, think about what tariffs do. They're a negative sum measure that reduces output for both sides and directly hits the pockets of consumers in a country imposing levies. But trade deals are positive sum, accelerating growth for their members, even as non-member countries are weakened. So this carrot and stick approach gives a really big inducement for outsiders to reform their economies in ways that would allow them to join a regional partnership, which is a scenario that the Trans-Pacific Partnership specifically had in mind.
The bottom line, of course, is whether this will be enough to shift China's economic model. Obviously, President Trump favors bilateral trade deals.
Yeah, I mean, it's an open question about this because, you know, sure, if WTO membership has failed to change Beijing's behavior, what hope would a smaller regional agreement have? But Fickling's point is, the breakdown in bilateral talks suggests the tariff-first approach isn't really working. So in the meantime, the other players in the rest of the world isn't standing still. And in fact, they're moving closer to their center of gravity is moving closer to Beijing's orbit. So the U.S. is going to need its own constellation of allies if it wants to reverse that.
Oh, and speaking of constellations of allies, Hal Brands is focusing on one in his piece this morning that focuses on an important anniversary that many might have missed.
So 20 years ago, NATO began its post-Cold War expansion into Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, and three new members came on board: Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic. So this anniversary was marked, in a rather subdued affair in Washington with no heads of state. And Brandt says this is a pity because NATO expansion ranks as one of the great U.S. foreign policy successes of the post-Cold War era.
So how did NATO beat back Russian aggression and expansion?
It's really interesting because, it was a crucial hedge against the failure of Russian reform and integration. Sure, America wanted to foster a democratic Russia that would join the rest, but in reality, it had to reckon with the dangers that might reemerge if liberalization failed and a more aggressive Russia emerged. And indeed, that is exactly what happened. In the intervening years, NATO expansion kind of moved the divide line between Moscow and the West much farther to the east. The idea is that there's many of Russian neighbors have security guarantees that still help to keep the Kremlin at bay. Russia has invaded and mutilated two countries under Putin's watch, Ukraine and Georgia. They are not NATO members. It has coerced and intimidated, but not invaded, any country that belongs to the alliance.
But just quickly, there's another side of the coin, though. I mean, there are some that think that NATO expansion was what sort of poked Russia in the first place.
Exactly. I mean, there was an idea that after the Cold War, it lost its purpose and should have been disbanded. But Brandt's point is that, the idea that there was going to be some anarchic hellscape that would emerge after the Cold War didn't happen. And instead, what we've seen is a Europe that moved forward and made great strides towards democracy and stability.
All right, Bloomberg opinion editor Jennifer Ryan, thank you. As always, read more at Bloomberg.com/opinion or OPIN Go on the Bloomberg terminal. Karen.
Thanks, Nathan. Now it's time for the Bloomberg Law Brief, exploring legal issues in the news. It's brought to you by American Arbitration Association. International trade or business dispute resolve faster with the International Center for Dispute Resolution, the leader in alternative dispute resolution around the world, ICDR.org. Today we're looking at a win for consumers at the Supreme Court and a big loss for Apple. The court ruled consumers can go ahead with an antitrust lawsuit that accuses Apple of using market dominance to artificially inflate prices at its app store. For more on this story, Bloomberg's June Grasso speaks to Mark Rifkin, the attorney representing the consumers in the class action suit.
Mark, this was a huge win for consumers. What made the difference?
I think the difference here is the way the court views the importance of enforcing the antitrust laws. Justice Kavanaugh made it very clear that the court will vindicate consumer rights when they're affected by antitrust violations. And I think that's an important principle.
This was a 5-4 ruling, and the swing vote was the newest justice, as you mentioned, Brett Kavanaugh, who joined with the court's liberal wing, which is an unusual alignment so far. And he sort of signaled that in the oral arguments.
We were very gratified with the kinds of questions that Justice Kavanaugh was asking because it made us think that he was going to apply Illinois BRIC the way the court has always applied it, which is in a very straightforward, very formalistic way without looking behind the transaction to the economics that Apple wanted the court to consider.
Let's go back for just a moment and tell us the issue in the case.
So under the Supreme Court's decision, 1977 decision in Illinois BRIC, the only plaintiffs who have standing to sue a monopolist are those who directly deal with a monopolist. And even if they may pass on some portion of their injury to downstream users, those downstream users don't have standing. The first person to deal with a monopolist is the one who has standing and can recover all the antitrust damages. And here, as Justice Kavanaugh says in the very first part of his decision, it's undisputed that iPhone owners bought apps directly from Apple, who is the alleged monopolist. So the way the Supreme Court has been deciding this issue for more than 40 years, it's the consumers who have the standing to bring this claim.
And that's Mark Rifkin, the attorney representing consumers in the class action suit against Apple, speaking to Bloomberg's June Grasso. You can listen to more legal analysis like this on Bloomberg Politics, Policy, Power, and Law, weekdays at 12 p.m. Wall Street time here on Bloomberg Radio. And find more legal news at BloombergLaw.com. Attorneys will find exceptional legal research and business development tools there as well. Visit BloombergLaw.com for more information. And Bloomberg Daybreak continues. This is Bloomberg.